Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of On Science. I'm Science Desk intern Megan Voss. This week, we'll hear about a link between the evolution of the human brain and cooking. Then, we'll find out how the brain chemical dopamine makes people impulsive. Also, a story on quantum teleportation. But first, in the aftermath of the Gulf oil spill, lawyers are gearing up for legal action against BP. Both sides are scrambling to hire the best expert witnesses, and scientists are being caught in the fray. NPR's Tovia Smith has more.
As soon as the magnitude of the Gulf oil spill became clear, it was all hands on deck.
That's the black mangrove. Their distribution and range has expanded over the past 20 years in coastal Louisiana. You wouldn't have seen this 20 years ago.
For months now, local scientists like LSU wetlands expert Andy Nyman have been out on Gulf waters advising the cleanup and measuring the damage.
Some of the carbon being photosynthesized by these marsh grasses today will be part of a menhaden that will end up in a piece of chicken that then you cook on your stove.
But there is growing concern that some of the best minds are being sidelined since they've signed on as paid consultants to BP.
Everybody's arming up for the big day in court.
Richard Shaw, director of Louisiana State University's Coastal Fisheries Institute, is one of many concerned that BP is buying up too much of the region's brain power.
You would think you would want to bring all the intellectual resources to bear. It's pretty frustrating.
Shaw says he has not been approached by BP, but many colleagues have.
I got a phone call from some lawyers representing BP.
University of South Alabama's Bob Shipp says BP's lawyers tried to hire his whole Department of Marine Sciences to do research for them. Under the deal, the scientists could only disclose their results if BP said so. Otherwise, they'd have to keep it secret for 3 years.
They wanted the oversight authority to keep us from publishing things if for whatever reason, they didn't want them to be published. People were muzzled. As part of the contract, they were muzzled. And certainly, it's not something that we could live with.
But other professors did accept BP offers at LSU, Texas A&M, and the University of Southern Mississippi. After a blast of public criticism, however, the Mississippi professors had a change of heart and backed out. They declined to comment. It's touchy, not just because of the academic integrity issue, but also public opinion.
I am a little concerned about everyone hating me if I was working for BP, so...
LSU wetlands scholar Andy Nyman chose instead to work for a lawyer suing BP. His deal calls only for expert testimony, not research, and he's not subject to any hush clause. But Nyman says he can only surmise how many others are, either for BP or the government agencies who will oppose them in court.
I'm guessing from the volume of people who are wetland experts that you do not hear from in the press right now, that everyone but me is locked in.
BP declined to be interviewed for this report, but in a statement, BP says its deals vary from large, no-strings-attached grants to universities to, quote, scientific experts for the purpose of litigation that need to be confidential.
It's the way things work. I mean, this happens every day, and no one should be surprised.
Mark Davis heads Tulane Law School's Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy. In some ways, he says BP is doing what other oil, tobacco, and pharmaceutical companies have done in the past by hiring scientists to do research they want kept secret. But he says in a case like this, the public will pay a big price if BP can constrain the free flow of scientific data.
When the best fishery scientists actually may have evidence that would work against you, but they're not able to present it to the other side or to the public, well, then you've essentially bought some silence.
It's a cagey legal strategy, but I do think it's a problem from a public standpoint.
That's attorney Robert Weigel, who represents fishermen, businesses, and environmental groups who are suing BP. He says the public interest really depends on access to a relatively small pool of specialists.
When you talk about the red snapper fishery or black mangrove swamps, there may be half a dozen people who fully understand those resources. And there needs to be full exchange of data so that we can all understand what happened to these public resources.
To many in academia, an underlying problem is the lack of other options for research. Shaw says universities have all but cut back and federal grant money has all but dried up.
There's a bunch of frustration. I mean, believe me, all the scientists want to get out there and contribute, for crying out loud. I mean, it's in our backyard. And so we're sitting there chafing at the bit, trying to get into the mix.
It only makes a lucrative offer like those from BP, Shaw says, all the more enticing. Tovia Smith, NPR News, New Orleans.
The next story could be called Food for Thought. In our series, The Human Edge, we have been examining the evolutionary changes that helped us become the most powerful species on the planet. This week, Christopher Joyce took a look at our diet, well, our ancestors' diets, and found out that there really is such a thing as brain food.
Our ancestors ate their food raw. Fruit, leaves, maybe some nuts. And when they ventured down onto land, they added things like underground tubers, roots, and berries. It wasn't a very high-calorie diet. To get the energy you needed, you had to eat a lot and have a big gut to digest it all. And let me tell you, having a big gut has its drawbacks.
You can't have a large brain and big guts at the same time.
Leslie Aiello is an anthropologist and director of the Venner Gren Foundation in New York City, which funds research on evolution. Digestion, she says, was the energy hog of our primate ancestor's body. The brain was the poor stepsister who got the leftovers, until we discovered meat.
What we think is that this dietary change around 2.3 million years ago was one of the major significant factors in the evolution of our own species.
That period is when cut marks on animal bones appeared. Not a predator's tooth marks, but incisions that could only have been made by a sharp tool. That's one sign of our carnivorous conversion. Aiello's favorite clue is ickier. It's a tapeworm.
The closest relative of human tapeworms are tapeworms that affect African hyenas and wild dogs.
So sometime in our evolutionary history,
we actually shared saliva with wild dogs and hyenas.
That would have happened if, say, we were scavenging on the same carcass that hyenas were.
Exactly.
But dining with dogs was worth it. Meat is packed with lots of calories and fat. Our brain, which uses about 20 times as much energy as the equivalent amount of muscle, piped up and said, "Please, sir, I want some more." As we got more, our guts shrank because we didn't need a giant vegetable processor anymore. Our bodies could spend more energy on other things, like building a bigger brain. Sorry, vegetarians, but eating meat apparently made our ancestors smarter. Smart enough to make better tools, which in turn led to other changes.
If you look in your dog's mouth or your cat's mouth, and then you open up your own mouth and look at that, our teeth are quite different. And what allows us to do what a cat or dog can do are tools.
Tools meant we didn't need big, sharp teeth like other predators. Tools even made vegetable matter easier to deal with. As anthropologist Shara Bailey at New York University puts it, they were like external teeth.
You know, your teeth are really for processing food, of course, but if you do all the food processing out here, you know, if you're boiling things, if you're grinding things, then there's less pressure on your teeth to kind of pick up the slack.
Our teeth, jaws, and mouth changed, as well as our gut. But adding raw meat to our diet doesn't tell the whole food story, according to anthropologist Richard Wrangham. Wrangham invited me to his apartment at Harvard University to explain what he believes is the real secret to being human. All I had to do was to bring the groceries.
You're a hero. My goodness, getting all this, hauling all this stuff up.
Let me take these out and show you what I brought. Got a bit of steak, which I hope can fill in for kudu or antelope or something.
Excellent.
Appropriate.
Okay, that's great.
And a turnip. You can take
oh,
it.
Oh, one. Excellent. Right, really good.
Well, since you're English, I thought that the idea would be to get some tubers and boil the hell out of them.
Absolutely.
Plus a mango, some peanuts, and potatoes. Wrangham says that even after we started eating meat, raw food just didn't pack the energy to build the big-brained, small-toothed modern human. He cites research that showed that people on a raw food diet, including meat and oil, lost a lot of weight. Many said they felt better, but also experienced chronic energy deficiency, and half the women in the experiment stopped menstruating. Now, it's not as if raw food isn't nutritious. It's just harder for the body to get at the nutrition.
Are you going to try some of this raw turnip?
You're going to make me do it.
Well, I'll try some too. They've got a tremendous amount of caloric energy in them. The problem is that it's in the form of starch, which, unless you cook it, does not give you very much.
Then there's all the chewing that raw food requires. Chimps, for example, sometimes chew for 6 hours a day. That actually consumes a lot of energy.
Plato said that if we were a regular animal, we wouldn't have time to sit around and write poetry. You know, he was right.
One solution might have been to pound food, especially meat, like this steak.
If our ancestors had used stones to mash the meat like this, then it would have reduced the difficulty that they would have had in digesting it. Are you going to try it?
I'll have at it. And that's quite easy to chew. It's not bad at all. But not as good as cooking that steak.
Onto the fire. Whoa.
That's what Wrangham says was the really big change that created our modern body. Someone discovered fire, no one knows exactly when, and then someone got around to putting steak and veggies on the barbie, like this one in Wrangham's kitchen. People said, hey, let's do that again. Besides better taste, cooked food had other benefits. For one thing, cooking breaks up the long protein chains in meat that makes them easier for stomach enzymes to digest.
The second thing is very clear, and that is that the muscle, which is made of protein, is wrapped up like a sausage in a skin, and the skin is collagen, connective tissue. And that collagen is very difficult to digest. But if you heat it, it turns to jelly.
As for the starchy foods, like our turnip, cooking gelatinizes the tough starch granules and makes them easier to digest as well. Even just softening food, which cooking does, makes it more digestible. In the end, you get more energy out of the food. Yes, cooking can damage some good things in raw food, like vitamins. But Wrangham argues that what's gained by cooking far outweighs the losses. But I'm going to have some of the steak sitting under my nose.
Great, okay.
Wrangham likes to think that cooking also led to some of the finer elements of human behavior. It encourages people to share labor. It brings families and communities together at the end of the day and encourages conversation and storytelling. All very human activities.
Ultimately, of course, what makes us intellectually human is our brain, and I think that comes from having the highest quality of food in the animal kingdom, and that's because we cook.
So, as the Neanderthals like to say around the campfire, bon appetit.
Cheers.
So, cheers.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Now, let's go a bit further into the human brain. The chemicals in our brain help carry signals from one part of the brain to another. But when it comes to brain chemicals, every person is unique. Science correspondent Jeff Brumfield looked at how brain chemicals can make some people more impulsive.
It's late at night. You're watching TV.
Would you love healthy, delicious snacks that are good for you? Do you love beef jerky but hate the preservatives and most of all the price?
You don't need a food dehydrator, but there's a part of you that wants it anyway. You look at your phone.
Call now.
What happens next may come down to how impulsive you are. Josh Buchholz is a researcher at Vanderbilt University. He studies why some people will buy a food dehydrator without hesitation.
These people with high levels of impulsive traits tend to leap before they look.
Impulsiveness is about much more than shopping. The same people are vulnerable to substance abuse and some forms of mental illness. Researchers like Buchholz think that the brains of impulsive people have too much dopamine. Dopamine is a chemical that our brain releases when it wants something. In Buchholz's case, that's a drink of water.
Yeah, that's refreshing. Okay.
So do you think dopamine was involved in your decision to drink?
Certainly. Well, you know, I had a thirst. I was driven to obtain the reward of that water. Dopamine was all over that behavior.
Dopamine is produced by neurons in the midbrain. That's the lower middle bit of the brain. It's then piped out to other regions where it creates the drive to get the things you want. Normally, sensors in the midbrain called autoreceptors keep dopamine at the right level.
And you can think of it as very similar to how a thermostat works. In your house, you have a furnace that produces heat and sends it through pipes all over your house. And a thermostat that sends a signal to your furnace to stop producing heat or to produce more heat if it's too cold.
The Vanderbilt researchers suspected that the dopamine thermostats of highly impulsive people are broken. To find out, they took 32 healthy volunteers, some impulsive and some not. They scanned their heads and found that, on average, impulsive people had fewer thermostats. To test the idea still further, the team gave volunteers a drug that releases dopamine and scanned their brains again. Sure enough, impulsive people released more dopamine.
The people who scored highest on a trait measure of impulsivity had upwards of 4 times the amount of dopamine released compared to the people with the lowest levels of impulsivity.
The work is published this week in the journal Science, but some researchers believe that there's more to impulsiveness than the dopamine thermostat. Ahmad Hariri is at Duke University. He thinks that other brain chemicals with their own thermostats also play a role.
It's becoming clear that the ability of these chemicals to regulate themselves through these thermostat mechanisms is absolutely crucial for how they regulate the brain and behavior.
Eventually, researchers hope that understanding how the brain's thermostats work could help them to develop better drugs and therapies for treating destructive behavior. Until then, try counting to 10 before deciding to
call now.
Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Quantum entanglement is a part of quantum mechanics that even Einstein thought was spooky. And it may have gotten spookier. Some scientists believe quantum entanglement may be the key for teleporting a living being. In a moment, we'll take a trip to a lab at the Joint Quantum Institute, where scientists have succeeded in transporting atoms from one location to another. But first, NPR's Guy Raz spoke with theoretical physicist Michio Kaku to try and learn more about what quantum entanglement actually is.
Well, welcome to the program.
Glad to be on the show.
Before we get to the teleportation, can you explain quantum entanglement for us?
Well, it's one of the most bizarre features of the quantum theory. According to the quantum theory, everything vibrates. And when two electrons are placed very close together, they vibrate in unison. And then when you separate them, that's when all the fireworks start. An invisible umbilical cord emerges connecting these two electrons. And you can separate them as much as a galaxy if you want. And if you vibrate one of them, then somehow on the other end of the galaxy, the other electron knows that its partner is being jiggled. Now, Einstein thought this was preposterous because it meant that in some sense, information can travel faster than the speed of light. Now, the information that travels faster than the speed of light is random information and hence useless for communication. However, vibrations that travel slower than the speed of light can in fact be used to teleport objects, somewhat similar to what you see in Star Trek, where you beam Scotty all over the place.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. I mean, how does entanglement figure into quantum teleportation?
It means that the information of one electron can be transferred to another electron. And in some sense, we are nothing but information. So if you can transfer the information content of an electron to another electron, then for all intents and purposes, it is that other electron.
Explain what some of the practical applications of this might be. I mean, if this technology is developed.
Well, the short-term applications are enormous in terms of computer technology. Realize that in 10, 15 years or so, computer power will exhaust the power of silicon. You cannot cram too many transistors on a silicon chip before you start to etch on individual atoms. At that point, we're going to have to go to quantum computers. So in the future, your desktop computer will probably no longer compute on silicon. They'll probably compute on atoms. And this is going to happen in the next few decades. The CIA is very much interested in this because you could crack any known code on the planet Earth with quantum computers. Now, going farther into the future, perhaps we'll master the ability to teleport entire molecules, maybe even living objects as well.
So let me just see if I got this right. It's not actually teleporting one atom to another place. It's just sort of taking the information from that atom to another
right.
place.
However, we think that your identity of who you are is basically information. So, you know, we have a problem that you have to be destroyed in order to have your body teleported to the other side of the room.
Mm.
So if you've now been destroyed and teleported, who is that person? They have the same memory, the same personality, the same jokes, everything, except the original was destroyed in the process of being teleported. So who is that other person there?
That's Michio Kaku. He's a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York and the host of Sci-Fi Science on the Science Channel. Michio Kaku, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now, it could be a long, long time before we're teleporting human beings, but it is being done with individual atoms. And we sent producer Brent Bachman to the University of Maryland to see how it all happens, and Brent is in the studio with me. What does that lab look like?
So they have this giant steel table there.
This one over here is where the teleportation experiment took place.
And who's that talking?
That's Dr. Christopher Monroe.
I'm at the Joint Quantum Institute at the University of Maryland and the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
He runs the teleportation experiments.
Okay, so these atoms that they're teleporting, they're all in the same room in that lab you saw?
Like a few feet apart, and Dr. Monroe and his team actually spend most of their time creating the right conditions for quantum experiments. So for teleportation, that means they need to isolate two atoms in two separate chambers.
We do vacuum plumbing. We pump air out of chambers. We make lasers and propagate optical beams. We do a lot of machining, a lot of fancy electronics to control these lasers and so forth.
They do all of this to isolate two atoms?
Yeah. So here's how they do it. They have two chambers, just a couple of inches wide, a few feet apart. They put the atoms in there, and then they suck all the air out.
That's not what it really sounds like.
No, not really. Then they levitate each atom.
So you can just think of a magnetically levitated train, tracks, if you want.
And then they charge the atom with an electric field.
So basically what you then have is a levitating, supercharged atom.
Right. Now here comes the fun part. Once the atoms are charged, they shoot each one with a laser.
That's not what it sounds like.
No, it's not.
And something very special happens then. The atom emits a single photon, sort of a particle of light.
And when those photons are released?
They interact with each other in a sense.
So let's recap. Once they've vacuumed the chambers, levitated the atoms, charged them, and shot each one with a laser, they get one photon from each atom. And when those photons interact?
Two atoms are now entangled.
Just let me clarify something. It doesn't really sound like that, right?
It actually doesn't make any noise at all.
Okay. But we've now got the invisible connection, Michio Kaku explained. I get that.
Right. And here, from here on out, it's kind of like hooking up a phone line. Now they can send information from one atom to another.
Okay. I'm still not clear here. How does this work?
Well, that's why quantum physics is kind of spooky. No one really knows why these two atoms can communicate information. But frankly, Christopher Monroe at the University of Maryland, he says he doesn't think too hard about any of all that. And because he doesn't think too hard about it, he could actually make some real progress on the road to things like quantum computers and communication technology.
We don't know where it's going. We don't know what it will look like 10 years from now. And that drives me every day because it's almost like playing the lottery in a sense. Very low probability that we're going to be able to make that breakthrough, but yeah, it's not zero.
That's Christopher Monroe from the Joint Quantum Institute at the University of Maryland. Brent Bachman is a producer on this program. Brent, thanks so much.
Anytime.
That's it for this week. For more science news, be sure to check out our website at npr.org/science. I'm Megan Voss. Thanks for listening.